Flagstaff, Arizona.
Berkeley, California.
Oakland, California.
Santa Cruz, California.
Sebastopol, California.
Boulder, Colorado.
Denver, Colorado.
New Haven, Connecticut.
Alachua County, Florida.
Tacoma Park, Maryland.
Amherst, Massachusetts.
Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Leverett, Massachusetts.
Northampton, Massachusetts.
Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Santa Fe, New Mexico.
Carrboro, North Carolina.
Eugene, Oregon.
Burlington, Vermont.
Madison, Wisconsin.
Those are the 20 American cities and towns that have passed resolutions condemning the USA Patriot Act's assault on the Bill of Rights in the name of the war on terrorism.
To the rich man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you, my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding in the damp foggy, you snort my good pony and you give me your best. For you know and I know, good horse amongst the rich ones, how oft times we go there, an unwelcome guest.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1 FM, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. 20 American cities and towns have passed resolutions condemning the USA Patriot Act's assault on the Bill of Rights in the name of the war on terrorism. Though many commentators have lamented the use of the September 11th bombings as a cover for squashing domestic dissent, this tactic began in earnest 30 years ago with another perpetual war, the war on drugs. Tonight we're going to bring you a forum on race, class, and the war on drugs that lays bare its intentions and effects then and now, the rolling back of hard-won rights by those at the bottom of society, the suppression of political movements that threaten the rule of wealth, and the diversion of taxpayer dollars into an industry of social control.
I don't know, good horse, as we trot in this dark heat, that robbing the rich is for worse or for best. They take it by stealing and lying and gambling, and I take my way, my shiny black horses.
The forum we're about to hear, Race, Class, and the War on Drugs, was recorded earlier this month in Seattle, Washington. Thanks to Mike McCormick for providing this tape.
Good morning and welcome to the King County Bar Association's Race, Class, and the War on Drugs Forum. My name is Karen Murray, and along with Dan Merkel, co-chair of the Race Class Disparity Task Force, I am also the current president of Lauren Miller Bar Association. Today we come together to learn, to discuss, and to hopefully arrive at some solutions to address the issue of race and class disparity. But before we begin our program, I would like to share something that was brought to my attention that relates to this very topic and to our efforts. It will put it all into context. On March 6th of this year, an email was circulated to members of our task force to alert us that Nightline, ABC, was broadcasting a series titled America in Black and White. The subject that evening concerned a Boston judge who has sentenced an African-American defendant to a short prison term based on the prosecution's insistence. The next day, the same judge saw a white defendant charged with virtually the same crime. The prosecution asked that there be no prison time for him. What this particular judge did next was the basis of the Nightline's broadcast. When the judge saw these cases one after the other, he noticed the following. One, that both cases involved small-time drugs. And two, that the amount of drugs were about the same. Then he saw what was glaringly different. The black defendant had no prior criminal history, whereas the white defendant did. The judge vacated the sentence of the African-American man, recused himself from the case, and called for an investigation. Needless to say, the district attorney's office denied that race played any part in the way they prosecuted these cases. And in the end, the African-American man did prison time. And the white defendant went to drug rehab. Go figure. There have been and continues to be complaints and suspicion that the criminal justice system treats individuals differently because of their race and their economical background. This Nightline piece gave us a case study of two cases which were sufficiently similar to lend credence to the thesis that there is indeed race and class disparity in the war on drugs and in our criminal justice system. And ladies and gentlemen, that is why we're here today. Approximately 2 years ago, the King County Bar Association decided to formulate the Race Class Disparity Task Force to address the issue of disparity in the criminal justice system. Our report is still in the drafting phase. However, what we can share with you today are some startling statistics which appear to support our theory that in the war on drugs, race and class does matter. So, the other members of the task force and myself look forward to not only sharing information, but hopefully arriving at some answers to these issues. So, again, thank you for coming, and now I will turn the podium over to my co-chair, Dan Merkel.
Thanks, Karen. Because we're behind schedule and because we have experts from around the country who are here today, I only get to say a few remarks. And I've spent the last 2 years immersed in these issues along with many other people, and I'd like to speak all day about what I've learned and what I've felt and what I've seen. It's beyond what I ever could have imagined in terms of the destruction to individuals' lives and communities in society. I think that the social fabric has been ripped away over the last 20 years as Washington State, along with most of the other states around the country, moved from a criminal justice system that has always been based on rehabilitation and support to one that has been based almost exclusively on punishment. Punishment for people that go inside the system and punishment for people that are outside the system. I think that we've had a lot of our political leaders that have stepped forward and acknowledged that we need more balance to our system, more focus on treatment, prevention, education, and we've been trying to work with those people as much as we can, but the whole system needs to have major, major changes. This isn't about incremental tweaking. This is about reversing 20 years of damage that's been done. It's not just that we need to stop incarcerating people who have mental health problems, substance abuse problems, but we need to focus on repairing the damage that's been done over the last 20 years. The people who are speaking today are incredible. We've got what we think are most of the leaders in this city speaking, who are focused on different aspects of these issues. But we're also very, very fortunate to have many of the top people across the country, many of whom have been in town for the last couple days for the Harm Reduction Conference that brought in 1,500 people from around the world. Many of those organizers and key speakers stayed an extra day to participate in our panel. And we also have several people who flew in from around the country just to participate for today. So I hope that we all learn a little bit more. I hope that we're inspired to increase the commitment that I think most people here have already evidenced in the work that they do, because we've got to start working together on major, major shifts in society. And I think that this range of issues is a good opportunity to educate people about the need to support those in our communities that have vulnerabilities and move away from the punishment model, particularly for those that really don't pose any threat to society. So thanks for attending. Bear with us throughout the day in terms of any inconvenience or confusion that might exist, because we do have a full house, and we've constantly been changing our schedule to make it as most interesting as possible to the group. And I think that we've come up with a great range of opportunities for people to hear from national leaders and local leaders, as well as to participate at lunchtime and in the afternoon, so that we can hear what everyone here also feels about these issues and the work that everyone's doing. And we're really interested in continuing to build relationships and work with particular community groups that are very involved in these issues. So we hope that you'll stay in touch with us, and we'll do our best to stay in touch with you. Our next speaker is someone who's been on the forefront of these issues for a long, long time, particularly for the last 8 years in his capacity with the King County Council and current chair of the Public Safety Committee. Larry Gossett has put these issues out for many years, not just in terms of the injustice and ineffectiveness of the criminal justice system, but how it relates to poverty and economic injustice and the torn social fabric that we've had. And as we've done our research over the last couple of years, one of the most rewarding things was to go out and find out who's been writing materials on it over the years. And Larry had kind of mapped a lot of this out a long time ago. And I feel like the rest of us are just starting to catch up with his vision and his commitment to these issues. So we're very excited and pleased and thankful for the work he's been doing, and most importantly for his participation in several different panels today. King County Council Member Larry Gossett.
The organizers of this event, since I am an elected official, a member of the King County Council, also asked me to formally welcome all of you here, particularly those of you who are visiting us from out of town. And I'd like to do that on behalf of the 1.7 million people who reside here in Martin Luther King County. Welcome. This is an all-day workshop to deal with the issue of race, class, and the war on drugs. Most of us who have organized this conference or are supporting the organizers of it are operating off the assumption that race and class bias is endemic to the criminal justice system in this community and across the country. It is important to us that just because we say that and you differ in terms of your opinion based on your experience reading or whatever, then we want to engage you at the table during the question and answer period, during the comment period, in hearing why you differ with us in terms of our analysis. And then as a result of that dialogue, it is our hope that by the end of the day, that most of the participants, and we do consider all of you to be participants in this affair, will have food for thought that they hadn't had before. Either some of us, in terms of our already believing that racial stratification is a natural part of the American society today as it was in the past, you might provide us some food for thought, some food for thought, and we might provide you some food for thought about how the criminal justice system operates. And even though, like my remarks during the few minutes I have, I want to stimulate some discussion, I want to stimulate some reaction. So I'm going to use some comparisons that some people are going to say are way out of pocket or not true, not right. But I want to hear later why you feel I'm not right. I want you to challenge me to say why I said what I said. And as a result, we think that this will be a very meaningful discussion for today here at Plymouth Congregational Church. And we also are really thankful for all of you taking a whole day out of your busy schedules or however amount of time it is that you can join us and participate. We are heartened and inspired by that. Here's my thing, that if the criminal justice system continues to operate as it currently is, that by the year 2017, we will have recreated a system of slavery very similar to that existed in 1863, and the new plantation will be the criminal justice system in this country, particularly the vast array of federal and state penitentiaries that we have in this country. Why do I, as an elected member of the regional government in this community, say that? I would like to draw your attention to a report that was done by Graham Boyd, who is the National Director of the Drug Policy Institute for the American Civil Liberties Union, who used very elaborate strategies and statistics for developing a chart. I don't think it's in your packet. I can have this made. But here's what he points out. That over the last year, from 1992 to 2002, there's been on average a 5.5% increase in the number of African American people, primarily males, but a growing number of women, who have entered the criminal justice system as prisoners, either at state or state prison, federal prison, or county jails, like here in King County, and that rate of growth has been about 5.5% per annum every year. 5% more blacks are in jail in this country than were in there the year before. If that rate of incarceration continues, by the year 2017, that there will be in our new American plantations, jails, 1,999,916 black people in U.S. prisons and jails. In the year 1860, there were 1,981,000 black males on the plantations in the 13 colonial states, southern states in this country. When slavery ended more or less 1863, there were 2 million black men, 2 million black women, 4 million people in slavery. The way our criminal justice system is operating, there'll be about 2 million black men in jail in the year 2017. Most of them, not all, most of them will be in there for drug-related crimes, because the majority of them are going to jail as low-level, nonviolent users and sometimes small-level distributors of drugs in various parts of our country. And they're going at extremely more rapid rate or pace than our white drug users and drug distributors in this country. In a country where most of the national studies that have been done in the last 10 years show that there is no objective difference in the percentage of people in the African American community, the Latino community, and the African American community who use and distribute illegal drugs. That is to say, that about 74% of all the people that use illicit drugs in this country are white. About 13 to 15% of the people in this country that use illicit drugs are African Americans. White people happen to be represented in this society at about 6.5 times black population. So objectivity would suggest that more or less there should be 5 or 6 times more people in jail for drug use in this country that are white than are black. But what do the statistics show? The statistics show that about 35% of all the people in the United States of America who are busted for drug use or trafficking, selling, are African Americans. About 55% in this country who are convicted are African Americans, or who plead are African Americans. But somewhere between 70 and 74% of everybody that goes to jail in the entire country are black people, mostly black males who are poor and from inner city communities throughout the length and breadth of this country. By way of statistics, since 1990, the number of black people in Alabama, where Sister Dorothy Gaines, who you're going to hear from a little later, comes from, there's been a 5,050% increase in blacks going to jail in the last 10 years. In Louisiana, there has been a 5,000% increase in the number of black people going to jail. So you don't just think this happens in the South. In Iowa, there's been a 4,500% increase in the number of black people going to jail. In Washington State, there's been over a 3,000% increase in the number of blacks going to jail, mostly for drug-related crimes. In Washington State, blacks make up 3% of the population, but there are about 25 to 27% of everybody in every state penitentiary in this country, most of them for nonviolent, low-level drug possession or distribution. Yet, in this society, 74% of the people that use drugs are white. What causes this disconnect? I'm always told through the articles that Dan say I write in this local community, the thing that I get most when I write these articles, they said, but the criminal justice system is colorblind. These laws around arrest and drug users weren't created to get blacks. They were created to get drugs off our streets, out of our community, away from our kids. You know, but this was and as a result, the majority of the people in our community and our society believe that these people are just reaping what they've sown. You know, if you go to King County Court down the street and 40% of the people on trial are African Americans who are poor, and nearly that many are in the King County Jail, they're reaping what they sow. It's not related to any differential targeting of drug users and sellers in particular communities. Or they will quote the Washington State Minority Justice Commission report that was produced a couple of years ago, and many of you are lawyers, and I know that many of you have heard of it, that said that there's no racial or ethnic impact as it relates to charging and sentencing for the possession processing of drug offenders in this state. But they don't deal with the initial contact between people in the community between the police and individuals. They don't deal with targeting. They begin with prosecutorial decisions and then decisions made by the courts and how they integrate and use mandatory sentencing. So in conclusion, I would like to say that the same kind of massive support of criminally inhumane public policies as relates to drug enforcement in this country existed when this country decided in the late 1870s to implement the Black Codes. People said that we need these laws in order to control this newly freed Black population. So they passed all kind of laws in the South saying if three or five Blacks are together on a city street, then you can arrest them for vagrancy. If they steal a chicken, you can give them 6 months or a year in jail. Then when they get to Parchman Prison in Mississippi or Angola in Louisiana, they got to do hard labor all day for nothing. And most of the public supported that until there was a movement to change it. Most white Americans supported slavery when Black people worked all day, sun up, sun down for nothing because they believed in the superiority of whites over Black. But we changed the attitudes after slavery. We changed the attitudes after the Jim Crow period. And I'm here to tell you that through the efforts like we're having today, that it's possible to change the hearts and minds of American people and the public policies of its elected leaders, but it will not occur without grassroots, dedicated, well-informed people becoming committed to significantly reforming the criminal justice system here in King County and throughout our nation. Thank you, and I look forward to talking to all of you later.
Thank you very much, Larry. Let me introduce Josie White from the University of Washington.
Good morning. I'm going to talk today a little bit, sorry for my voice, I'm not feeling too well. I'm going to talk a little bit about the history of the war on drugs, and because my time is limited, I'm not going to be able to lay out the whole history, but I just wanted to give you guys a few things to think about as you move through the day and we have this discussion. Like alcohol, the classification of certain drugs as legal or illegal has changed over time. Too often, these classifications have had racial and class overtones. At the beginning of the 20th century, there were virtually no restrictions on opium, cocaine, and marijuana. These drugs were freely available from mail order catalogs, pharmacies, and grocery stores, and used both medicinally and recreationally by people throughout the United States. Opium, valued for its soothing effects, was an ingredient in many health remedies. Likewise, marijuana was widely used in corn cures and cough preparations, and cocaine, initially considered to be a miracle drug, was introduced commercially in the 1880s and was used as a remedy for hay fever, seasickness, diphtheria, syphilis, and fatigue. Coca-Cola, which used cocaine in its syrup, first advertised it as brain food. American pharmaceutical companies and patent medicine manufacturers used marijuana, cocaine, opium, and their powerful derivatives in a wide variety of products. Marketing was unrestrained, and the American drug business was highly profitable. Studies published between 1871 and 1922 paint a striking portrait of the typical opium or cocaine addict in the early 20th century. She was a white, middle-aged, rural, middle-class, or upper-class woman. The peak of opium dependence in the United States occurred near the turn of the century. Yet despite the relative prevalence of addiction, the prevailing attitude at the time was that drug addiction was a health problem, best treated by physicians and pharmacists. Public attitudes about drug use began to change, however, as perceptions about drug users shifted. Opposition to opium smoking grew as it was increasingly linked to Chinese immigrants in the Western United States. Strong anti-Chinese sentiment, exacerbated by a growing fear of competitive cheap Chinese labor, led to the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, which forbade further Chinese immigration. Earlier in 1875 and 1876, the first laws against opium smoking were passed in San Francisco and Virginia City. The San Francisco Ordinance was aimed specifically at the smoking of opium, which was seen as a peculiarly Chinese habit, not at the medicinal opium regularly consumed by white people. Opium itself was not outlawed and remained available in a number of over-the-counter products. In 1883, Congress passed the tariff on opium. Congress raised the tariff on opium prepared for smoking from $6 to $10 per pound, and in 1886 it prohibited altogether the importation of the kind of weak opium that was used for preparing smoking opium. The 1887 law also prohibited the importation of opium by Chinese, and a law 3 years later limited the manufacture of smoking opium to American citizens. In 1902, the Committee of the Acquirement of the Drug Habit of the American Pharmaceutical Association declared, "If the Chinaman cannot get along without his dope, we can get along without him." Despite the overwhelming evidence that middle and upper class white people as a group consumed drugs at a far greater rate than any other, opiates and cocaine were widely viewed as substances associated with foreigners or alien groups. In the early 20th century, cocaine became associated with black people. In 1910, Dr. Hamilton Wright, considered among the fathers of U.S. anti-narcotic laws, reported that U.S. contractors were giving cocaine to their black employees to get more work out of them. Added to the stories which depicted Chinese people as opium vampires preying on children were stories depicting black people as, quote, cocaine-crazed Negroes, unquote. The New York Times published an article on February 8, 1914, which was titled, "Negro Cocaine Fiends, New Southern Menace." An excerpt from that article reads, "The drug produces several other conditions which make the Negro fiend a peculiarly dangerous criminal. One of these conditions is a temporary immunity to shock, a resistance to the knockdown effect of fatal wounds. Bullets fired into vital organs that would drop a sane man in his tracks fail to check the Negro fiend, fail to stop his rush or weaken his attack." As a result of ignorant stories such as these, some Southern police departments actually switched to .38 caliber revolvers. This type of propaganda was motivated in part by a desire to persuade Southern members of Congress to support the proposed Heroin Narcotics Act, which would greatly expand the federal government's power to control drugs. Such lies were also necessary, even though drugs were widely used in America. Up until that point, very little crime was associated with users. From 1913 to 1916, In 1914, Congress adopted the Harrison Narcotic Act. It was the first federal law to impose registration and record-keeping requirements on the production and sale of opiates and cocaine. In the next 10 years following the adoption of the Harrison Narcotic Act, as clarified by the Supreme Court, opiate habituation became a crime instead of an illness. From 1913 to 1916, as there became larger numbers of Mexican workers coming into the United States, anti-Mexican propaganda began to proliferate, demonizing Mexicans and labeling cannabis by a Mexican slang name, marijuana. Before the Depression, cheap Mexican labor had given the West its muscle, but with 18 million unemployed whites in the breadlines, the brown-skinned guest workers were now looked on as thieves. In the early 1960s, the reinvigorated war on drugs declared by President Nixon targeted and effectively criminalized both groups of his, both groups of his staunchest critics, youth and urban minorities. Black, Latino, Native American, and many Asian youth were portrayed as purveyors of violence, traffickers of drugs, and a danger to society. Surveillance was focused on communities of color, immigrants, the unemployed, the undereducated, and the homeless, who continue to be the principal targets of law enforcement efforts to fight the war on drugs. As drugs become linked in the public mind with certain vulnerable and unpopular groups in society, drug users were no longer viewed as victims of careless doctors or American drug companies, but rather were and continue to be viewed as suspicious deviants who undermine the nation's stability. And I'll just end there.
Good morning. I do believe that one of the toughest jobs in the city and in the county and probably all over the nation is to go on with drug law enforcement with such limited resources and so much historical and other baggage that we really, really are dealing with. But it's also my unenviable task this morning to talk about just that, and in particular, the Seattle Police Department, not necessarily because it is the example of problematic law enforcement tactics that have been going on, but because it happens to be in the city of Seattle where we are. I am here to talk about more specifically the discretionary decisions that are made at some of the critical stage junctures in criminal justice system, but more in particular, way upstream at the arrest stage and even slightly pre-arrest stage. The reason is that many reports, and I know Roger has also mentioned that our 1999 state report, along with many other reports, have continuously indicated that, you know, we keep looking at these sentencing disparities, we keep looking at these charging disparities, and yet, you know, because of this mandatory sentencing law that we've been working with, and because no individual prosecutor or a judge has that much discretion at each juncture, that it really, the problem must be somewhere else, somewhere upstream. After all, as they say, prosecutors can only charge only those cases that the law enforcement officers bring to them, and the judges would then come and say, yeah, I can only sentence those that have been convicted as a result of filing by the prosecution. You know, there are some problems with each and every one of those, you know, a little bit too fast and simple explanation, but let's just, you know, so be it for the time being. So what is the problem then upstream, way up there with the way the law enforcement strategies have been deployed, particularly in the city of Seattle? All of the data that we have been looking at, and these are all published official public health or court records. All of the data that we have been looking at indicate this. The biggest racial and class disparity that is apparent in drug law enforcement statistics seems to come from those law enforcement operations that employ the highest level of discretions, namely things like undercover operations, and namely, and most specifically, by bust operations where undercover officers actually go out to look for drugs from people who would be willing to either deliver or sell to them. Let's also be clear about a couple other things while we are at it. Some close to 90% of those drug arrests that are called drug trafficking or drug offense arrests in the city are what's called small street level drug offenses. When we say small levels, for those of you who are not familiar with criminal justice system and drug laws in particular, we're really talking about small levels. For instance, It is very, very common for the in most cases, you're looking at a speck, just a little tiny piece of something that a person would be using for one use at the most. In other cases, it's not even that. So nearly all of the drug arrests we're talking about are small level. The other very distinct part about all this is that nearly all of these are what's called public sales or public consumption. They are at the street level. And so by the definition of street level, by the definition of small level transactions, we are now really getting into the implications of race and class in drug law enforcement here. Now, what do we mean by, you know, disparity? I know we've been talking about disparity a lot from all of the numbers that we're looking at this morning. At one point, I know Roger was talking about in the state, African Americans were 6.6 times more likely than a white to be arrested for a drug offense, and in King County was like 10 times. Well, the latest official figure that we have for the city of Seattle is 22 times. So what do we mean by this 22 times, six times, and 10 times racial disparity? As you know, in the city of Seattle, about 8% of the population is African American, and about 57% of the latest figures would indicate that African Americans, 57% of the drug arrests were African Americans. So 22 times actually comes from that. Now, some of you, I'm sure, would think that that does not quite seem convincing if you're just comparing the regular population versus the data for, you know, available data for arrests and conviction and such data. Well, then I guess the ideal thing would be to know just exactly how many people in the city of Seattle, for instance, are truly committing drug law offense, and then how many are actually being arrested. Well, that's not going to come by, and that kind of figure is nowhere, anywhere that I know of in any city or state. But what's very close to that is what's been quite reliably, good indicia of the estimated potential offenders, and those are people who are drug users, and you've been hearing about a lot of numbers about drug users. Those drug users are possessors, and drug possession is a felony crime. And drug possession also, at the least, is drug possession, and that also involves delivery and sales from one of the parties or some of the parties involved in the transaction. Looking at all of the indicia, that includes the Department of Alcohol and Substance Abuse, that includes overdose raids, emergency mentions, several other King County specific, but also touching on the Seattle area, public health records indicate that includes the jail inmates' use record as well. They are all incredibly consistent with the national data, the state data, county data, and in most cases actually higher, more stark. In the case of heroin, for instance, according to the needle exchange data, the client population in the downtown core is more like 38% black, but in Capitol Hill or in Broadway, 98 and 99% white, respectively. Those are startling figures. So getting back to the issue of discretion, just what is happening upstream that accounts for this kind of stark, incredible, gross disparity? There seem to be like two unwritten models or goals of the police department that is admittedly, lacking resources and a clear mandate from the nation and from the state. And that is, go where visible complaints and problems are. And number two, do the kind of operation that would help prosecution prosecute properly. So, first of all, visible drugs, that would be only those complaints where they actually would produce a very easy to go out and target, not necessarily because they are particular demographics, but because they are easy to target. Now that's what the police of every police officer and every unit commander will tell you, that we do not go out and specifically target any particular demographic or social class, but that is the easiest place to go and get the arrests. There's a real problem with that, but I do know that they believe that that is the case. The other thing is, because they use undercover operations, it involves 10 to 12 officers in uniform and also undercover. They make traditionally very credible witnesses at trial and at sentencing. And so it's convenient, it's well done, and it's productive. What else can you do as law enforcement officers within what they perceive as limited resources? Well, I think there are a lot of things, but for the most part, they are, because they are lacking the mandate, clear sense of what their goals are, they are obviously completely ignoring the entire problem of what drugs, if there are drug problems that are really infesting all of the communities, all of these other communities that are, you know, white populated communities are not being the recipient of this benefit of drug arrest. They're also not being sent to any proper, through proper channels for any kind of drug treatment. But you know, here is the biggest thing about the systemic problem. Granted that the disparity seems to truly start way upstream, does that then mean that's the end of the problem? Prosecution can just throw up their hands and judges can throw up their hands and say, look, what can we do? We're just here, the recipients of these high numbers that are coming in. You know, here's another way of looking at it. We all know that it's not necessarily drug law enforcement, but it's really more like quality of life enforcement. What that means is that law enforcement is going out there trying to do what they think they can to stem a tide of not drug problems, but the complaints, citizens' complaints, and any other less civilized way of doing drugs in the city. Well, if we understand that, and in addition, if we also understand that we're all swimming in this muck of historical legacy of racism and our own stereotypes about social class, if we understand that as well, then all of us in criminal justice system, it must be responsible. It behooves all of us to look at each system and say, look, so these numbers are coming to me at the filing stage, at the sentencing stage. What do we do about this? Well, since it's not necessarily drug law enforcement, and since this does not necessarily represent all or not even half of the reality of the market out there and drug problems, we should deal with it at that level, not according to the statutory, not according to the other drug law policy that that so far has not been working, but it's in the book. At the sentencing level as well, for those African Americans and people of limited means who come back again and again with prior history, instead of just looking at that as these are repeat offenders, what can we do about this? Well, what if you look at that again, not as a felony drug law problem, but as a repetition of the same problem that goes on and on and on at upstream? I think it behooves all of us, yet again, to look at this at each juncture and say, we have the discretion to look at this, and we have the responsibility to do something about it. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Casey. Here's Karen Murray.
Thank you. I wonder how many of you have heard about a book called Doesn't It Make You Want to Holler? Black folks use that term a lot. And every time I sit and listen to this thing on race and class disparity in the criminal justice system and actually listen to the statistics and actually listen to the stories, sometimes I just want to holler. It is my privilege to introduce to you the first panel discussion this morning on racial disparity in the criminal justice system and the war on drugs. The moderator for this panel discussion will be Ms. Deborah Peterson Small. Ms. Small is a native New Yorker and a proud graduate of the City College of New York and a Harvard Law School graduate. Before assuming her current position at the Drug Policy Alliance, she was legislative director of the New York Civil Liberties Union. It was during this period that she became an ardent advocate for drug policy reform. As she became increasingly aware of the number of young black men and women incarcerated for drug offenses. She is regularly privileged to speak to the public, elected officials, and religious and community leaders, as well as parents about issues relating to our government's failed drug policy. Ms. Small, thank you for taking time out of probably a very busy schedule. Thanks for being with us today. Next to Ms. Small is panelist Lisa Dugard. Earlier I stated that she was the staff attorney with the Defenders Association and also member of the Racial Disparity Project. Personally, I just want to say that I have watched and learned many things from her, and I am very proud to call her a colleague and a friend. I now will turn over the panel to Ms. Small, who will now moderate this discussion. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. I'm really, really happy to be here and proud to have the opportunity to be part of what I think is going to be a groundbreaking effort here in Washington State. You all are directly across from my home state of New York, where people used to think that progressive politics originated. But as I get more and more involved in political activity on a national level, I realize that innovation is really coming more from the West, and that those of us on the East are looking to you for guidance, for support, and for showing us a better way of doing some things than we've been doing up till now. I just want to raise three issues to provide a context for the discussion that we're going to have today. And I want to pick up on the theme that was started by Councilman Larry Gossett in his remarks earlier on, where he said some things that were deliberately designed to provoke people because he wanted to generate more in-depth conversation around these issues. So the question that I want to add to the one that he raised is the war on drugs really about drugs? Or is it a social policy designed to accomplish other, more covert goals? I believe that some of the evidence that you've heard this morning suggests that, in fact, our drug war has less to do with limiting the use, distribution, or abuse of the substances that we've made illegal because we've only applied it to small populations, and more to continue to do with limiting the use, distribution, or abuse of the substances that from the beginning of the country. Only applied it to small populations. I wanted more to issue continue up to with limiting the use distribution of the use substances that beginning from the. It's important for people to understand apply small applied to populations. I wanted more to just issue continue up to with limiting the use districts with lots of other areas in life that substance beginning about it from the. It's important for people to for people to stay small applied it to populations. It's more to just call continue death. With any minority could use districts with lots of other areas in substance life that community about it from the. It's important for people to understand for people completely preventable patients. It's just you that in more state of continuum with any minority could use districts lots of other areas in substance injection drug used from the. We're able to understand for people completely preventable. I think we patients. It's progress that in more state of continuum with any minority from 50% to 30% lots of other areas. Substance injection drug you to place where people to understand completely for people preventable patients drill its progress that in more state of content early on in the 50s epidemic or to 30 lots of other areas inject substance and drug use were to play people to understand complete worsely provisions as drill never had you that in more state of content early on in the 50s epidemic or to 30 HIV other areas injector use were able to of the systemic worsens as drill never had you that in more state of continue in curly availability epidemic or to 30 HIV providing injects this to use were able to of the systemic worse situations HIV AIDS had to that in significant state of epidemic in that country. Also third HIV providing injections this to people to unwe of the systemic showed a worse situations of what happens had huge state of significant epidemic in that epidemic or of the third HIV providing injections this to result of their involved the state drugs showed a worse situations of what happens had huge northwest contin significant epidemic in that African American men are HIV able to inject this to result of felony involved systemic drugs showed a worse situations of what happens very different political scene in our epidemic in that African American men are HIV able to inject this to result less felony involved to epidemic hate in our democratic form once of what happens very different political scene in our epidemic in African American now we work in men are able to 90s where our economy was felony less involved to epidemic hate in our democratic form economy what happens very different political scene low unemployment rate but I work in that in men are able to these where 90 our economy felony rate less involved to epidemic hate in our democratic form rate economy happens what happens very different not considered to be imminent rate but I make in that in men are able to these where county jail or condolence involved mission rest to epidemic hate so what do you think it would have economy very different not considered to be imminent rate but I make in that in men people to these where are in pre-jail who are county jails and in to epidemic hate so what do you would have think economy ones are very different not considered and to be want to say about that and people to give in who jail or county jails and in epidemic countries that one way that you can appear to have a healthy economy and disappear your social problems is by locking them away in penitentiaries. I don't think that that's consistent with a country that claims it wants to be a beacon of freedom. So that's all I want to say, and I'm really, really happy to be here with the other panelists, and I'm going to turn it over now to
I think the thing that I want to take away from the statistical and other presentations that we heard this morning, earlier this morning, is this, that locally there is clearly a phantom population of white drug offenders who will never become acquainted with the downside and the upsides, such as they are, of the criminal justice system. And that's the topic that I want to focus on in my brief remarks. I know that everybody wants to talk to the panel, so I'll be very quick. This disparity that is kind of the starting point for our discussion today, there's a temptation in a panel such as this to have the conversation focus on the question, whose fault is it? And Dan alluded to that, to feeling like that's kind of the framework for this panel. So I want to posit that what if it's all of our fault? What if it isn't John's fault? And what if it isn't Dan's fault? And what if one just assumes for the sake of argument very good intentions on the part of law enforcement, on the part of prosecutors, on the part of judges. I'm not saying that that's true. I'm saying let's just assume for the sake of this discussion that it is. And I'm not saying that it's not. We have differences of opinion about that in this room. Let's set that question aside and just say, what if it's not those individual people's intention or fault that we're in the situation that we're in? And I want to ask, what difference does that really make? What if it's just all of our fault? I want to propose a test for any way that we as a society and we as a local community decide to go forward on drug policy. And that is this, that if we're doing something worth doing, if we're doing something worth expending enormous financial and human resources on, if we're doing something good and worth defending, then let's do it to everybody. If we're not going to do that, I think it raises important, perhaps devastating questions to the assumption or the argument that what we're doing is good. Because if we're not willing to do it to everybody, the reason probably is that it's not really a good, constructive, or necessary way to intervene in people's lives. The reason probably is that it's not really a good, constructive, or necessary. Incredibly important for us all, particularly those who participate in critiques of the present, the status quo in drug policy and the way that drugs are treated in the criminal justice system, to acknowledge the tremendous social pressures to which law enforcement and prosecutors, to perhaps a lesser extent, and even judges are responding. And this is why I say, what if it's all of our fault?
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Unwelcome Guests. You've been listening to a forum on race, class, and the war on drugs. We continue.